Research. The word itself might seem heavy. It might seem to be something rarefied, as if you already need to be an expert. As if to research, you need to be sequestered away in a laboratory with the microscopes and the test tubes with the Bunsen burners on. It can be that for sure. But what research also means is to stop, to pause, to look again. To look carefully, systemically, at nature, culture, and human-made things, or even human-made problems. Does the world around you have you scratching your head right now, wanting to know more, desiring to unlock the mysteries that surround us? Maybe you feel that traditional research journals are too dense, too full of jargon. Then this podcast is for you. We're highlighting the work of professors and students at Mount Royal University whose research is making real change in the world around us. And we're going to have some fun while doing it. My name is Natalie Meisner. I'm a poet, a prof, and a mom. Not necessarily always in that order, and I'm your host for Definitely Not the Ivory Tower. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Definitely Not the Ivory Tower. And today we are so happy to have with us Dr. Crystal Chokshi to look at some of the emergent issues in AI and predictive text and how that impacts our life right now. Dr. Chokshi has been a Shirk Doctoral Fellow, a Killam Scholar. Her work has been published in the Canadian Journal of Communication, Surveillance and Society, Culture Machine, Real Life, and The Conversation Canada. We would like you to please keep your eye out for her forthcoming book, The Need to Rename Tech. Welcome to Definitely Not the Ivory Tower, Dr. Chokshi. So here on Definitely Not the Ivory Tower, we're looking at academic research that has strong connections to real-world applications. Dr. Chokshi, could you tell us about how your own research in AI and predictive text, how that has real-world applications?
I like to think that I rewrite big text stories. That's how I like to think of what it is that I do. And it's so important, I think, to be questioning big tech at this particular moment in time, like you said, a moment that is seeing a huge rise in artificial intelligence technologies, and when we're being really asked to accept them. So I like to think of my work as rewriting big tech stories and really trying to disrupt what big tech promises to be doing. It wants to tell us that it is sort of saving the world, and my work asks people to really think about that and to really adopt a different lens when it comes to using and encouraging other people to use technologies.
Just to go back to some of the roots of this podcast, we are looking at the term change maker, or some folks will use pracademic. Do either of these feel like a good fit for you?
I think the word pracademic describes me, and it's a word I only came across because of you, actually. Aww. I didn't know this term before, sort of frantically looking it up to make sure I could speak to it here. But I come to academia having had about 15 years in the corporate communications world, and before that was in academia. So I come back to it with 15 years working in the corporate world and thinking really seriously about how to bridge these two worlds together. Because everything that I do here at Mount Royal University and with students, I'm always thinking toward not just the academic practice of a thing, but the practice in real life of a thing. How can we do things here, challenge things here that will end up getting more broadly, you know, used and challenged beyond these walls? So practice to me is really, really important. It's really important to be thinking about my own practice and how theory informs practice and practice informs theory, and then also how I can do a good job of supporting my students in developing a theory-based and academic-based practice. I teach in the public relations department, which is a very industry practice-focused degree, and so I'm always thinking toward with my students, what skills can I equip them with from academia and from this field that they can use.
Right. So they can kind of walk over that bridge from the academic environment out to the workforce. I feel like that's one of the things that we try to do here. And at Mount Royal. And I think, you know, not to up us up real big, but that is one of the things that I think we really do well. So thanks for that. Changemaker, Precademic, I think we slide them in and out. You know, they're kind of, you know, sometimes adjacent or sometimes the same. How about Changemaker? Is that one you...
I think that's one that makes me feel a bit nervous about identifying with, because I would leave it to my students or my colleagues to gauge if I'm doing that. So it feels like a term I can't adopt myself, but I would love for somebody else to call me that eventually one day, right? That the work does make a difference, or, you know, the work has had an impact. So I'll stick with Pracademic for now. I know I can attach myself to that label, and I would say I aspire to be called a change maker.
That's lovely. It is sometimes others who recognize you as that first. So that's totally fair. So could you tell us then about a light bulb moment when you felt that your research on artificial intelligence, predictive text, like when you felt your research was really connecting with communities and making a difference? You know, maybe want to talk about your book that's coming out, or any of the, you know, when this research kind of caught fire for you.
I think one moment that made me feel like the work that I do makes a bit of a difference actually happened here at Mount Royal University, and at one of our faculty council meetings, a number of us were invited to do a lightning talk about our work. And so I got up to do my lightning talk about the environmental impacts of artificial intelligence, and to show a creative project that illustrated some of these impacts of artificial intelligence. And I remember that as soon as I sat down, one of my colleagues got up right after me and just froze, because he was also going to be talking about artificial intelligence, but from a completely different angle. And he said, how am I supposed to still speak about what it was I was going to speak about, given what you just said? And so to see a colleague be in the moment and be willing to admit that what I had just said changed his mind about something.
Amazing.
Was a really cool moment. And he would go on later to invite me to another panel that he had organized at Mount Royal, where we discussed artificial intelligence and like the stakes and the pros and the cons and the impacts and the hidden consequences. And that was another moment where I got to see, you know, 50 people in the room ask questions that they weren't asking 5 minutes earlier, 10 minutes earlier. Oh, wow. And to be able to work through that together in real time with students, with colleagues, with administrators, you know, with my dean, that was a really amazing moment. And something that Mount Royal is so good at, to sit together and work through things.
Right, collegially discuss differences and come at it with kind of open and curious minds. That is lovely. And just that, so in this instance, nobody was really thinking about the environmental aspect of it. They were thinking about how it could be useful, or, you know, all the other fascinating angles, how it could, I've heard some great conversations about how its applications in healthcare can really help folks, you know. So in that environment, you were able to just introduce the environmental angle and it reframed things.
Exactly. I mean, I think we're so conditioned, and the public conversation is so focused on AI as a tool for business, which means AI as a tool for efficiency, for optimization, for accelerating tasks, for being, you know, the next big thing that's meant to sort of save the workforce. And I try to challenge that in my work in different ways. And so in that moment, you know, in that faculty council, to be able to see a colleague say, my thinking has now changed. That was a very cool moment.
So let's get into it in terms of your relationship to AI, how it's changed over time. How do you currently use it, and how have your views and opinions on it shifted over the years?
So it's no secret in my department, and it probably will be no secret to many people now after this podcast, that my relationship to AI is fraught, very fraught. And the truth is that that hasn't changed too much over the last several years. I started working on generative AI, specifically predictive text, in 2018. And I think in the years since 2018, I have only become more skeptical and a bit more nervous about the directions societally that we're headed in the embrace of this particular technology. So my relationship is very fraught. Like I said, I'm a skeptic. I don't use it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not an expert in, for example, the field you just mentioned a moment ago, uses of AI in healthcare,
right?
Or uses of AI in warfare, or right. uses of AI in sort of those really, really high stakes projects. Mm-hmm. I'll limit my comments to the work that I do, which is around generative AI for writing.
Right.
Right. So like the ChatGPTs of the world.
Yeah.
Like I said, my relationship is fraught and I don't use any of it, because what I've learned in the course of my studies and in my work is that there are so many hidden consequences to generative AI that aren't broadcast in right. marketing campaigns. They aren't the things that big tech is highlighting about their products. But the consequences are serious for a lot of people, economically, politically, and socially. Mm-hmm. And I think we have increasingly a responsibility to be aware of those consequences and to really think about the impacts of our choices.
Mm, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, especially in an environment where it can feel sometimes that the argument is, if you're not wholeheartedly embracing AI, then you are taking part of, you know, with some antiquarian, it's like, well, the printing press one day was supposed to ruin us all and we lived through that. You know, so there's that kind of, it's like you're a dinosaur if you don't adopt and you have to change. And there's that rhetoric that I feel it's very important to be resistant to. And there's a great need, I think, for skeptical voices and voices coming from all across the spectrum, shall we say, of how we could use this technology or how we need to be wary of it and its costs. So I love, that's one thing I really loved in your body of work that I was able to get to know, is that you were kind of going, yes, I'm a skeptic. Like that's your, you know, your stance is not, I'm not going to tell you that I know every healthcare application or that, you know, but I am a skeptic in terms of the what it can accomplish in the world and also what it might be doing to us that we don't know. So let's talk again about that framing. How do big tech companies currently frame their AI products?
I'm smiling here because big tech is just so masterful at branding and at marketing. And sitting here, you know, we remember that even as little as 2 years ago, 3 years ago, there wasn't really any talk about artificial intelligence, right? It wasn't really on our radar.
Right.
So in the span of, let's say, 2 to 3 years, big tech launched an incredibly persuasive campaign that artificial intelligence, and again, generative AI, I'm talking about mm-hmm. the things that generate text, generative AI is the future. It's hard to escape that discourse now. It's hard to argue against that. It's hard to actually be a skeptic today, because they've so successfully positioned AI as the future that if you are not on board with it, you are anti-future. You're anti-progress. You are anti-future. You are anti-innovation. You are anti-student education.
Whoa.
You are anti-everything if you are not pro-AI today. You can't be against technology today because then you are immediately positioned as a naysayer. Or
a Luddite.
Luddite. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's so easy to malign those folks today because they appear to be anti-innovation, and innovation seems to be
the most
revered value right. of all, you know, of all right now. So big tech has done an incredible job in a very short time to position AI as the future. And not just as the future, but they've endowed it with these other qualities, like it's magical. And the language that they use is around magic. There's a great article written recently by Peter Nagy and Gina Neff that talks about invoking the language of magic, specifically by generative AI companies, how they lean on the language of magic to dazzle us, but actually to conceal the realities of generative AI. Generative AI is often positioned as godlike. Like almost any headline you take a look at, you know, in the papers these days, mention something religious
about artificial intelligence, right? It sees into the future. It gives us information we've longed to have that traditionally only religious texts have been able to give us, or some type of spirituality. So big tech has painted generative AI as the all-powerful, all-seeing future. And who wants to be anti-future? Like, nobody. Right. So
it's an article of faith.
Yeah,
it's almost exactly. Like you're arguing against faith or kind of revelation or truth or...
That's an incredible word. Yeah, yeah, revelation. You are sort of against revelation.
And then it's interesting, right? Because I want to just go back real quick to the Luddites. And I won't go down this wormhole for too long, but I looked into the actual Luddites and they were actually kind of cool.
Well, and this is the thing about Luddites. So we still use this as a shorthand, right, for being anti-tech. But I did some reading about this too, and it turns out they weren't anti-tech. They were for progress, but concerned about consequences.
Yes,
right?
for progress, but concerned about consequences. But that's not now. If someone uses that term, it's been reassigned.
It has, and it now is right the shorthand for being anti something, particularly anti technology.
Oh wow, right. This is really fascinating to me. So moving a little bit through some of the things we want to get to today, I think you've addressed how the industry is kind of selling their products, how they're getting this buy-in. They're tapping into streams of thought that we love, magic, science fiction. Like, that's one of the streams that I've heard of artificial intelligence before, is in this kind of generative speculative fiction mode, where it sometimes can be, magical on the one hand, sometimes sinister on the other. But there never seems to be really a moment where we can stand there and kind of hold it to account.
Accountability is the thing that big tech shies away from, and that's a charitable phrasing of that. They completely renege on accountability in a number of different ways. And I think one of the problems with generative AI is that they're continuing this behavior. They're continuing this trend of stepping back from accountability. We're seeing that in terms of the copyright lawsuits that have been brought forward to companies like OpenAI, who've trained a product on stolen materials.
Yes.
We're seeing it in relation to the stories about the human labor that actually underlie artificial intelligence, which plays out a colonial dynamic. So companies like OpenAI and Meta farm out the training of their artificial intelligence systems, often to workers in Kenya and Ghana in very exploitative conditions. Mm-hmm. And they can step back from that accountability as well. So accountability and big tech are probably mutually exclusive terms.
Oh, wow.
That's
where we're at.
I would say. I feel pretty confident in that phrasing right now.
So that takes us into a term. I mean, sometimes in these discussions, you run across a term like data colonialism. Right. And then the top of your head comes off. You're like, wait, how are they getting so much buy-in? How did this happen to us? And then someone puts two words together, like data colonialism. So I would love for you to unpack that a little bit for us and frame it for us a little bit. And, just set that up for us. What is it? What can we do?
So data colonialism, my first encounter with the term was in a book called The Cost of Connection by Nick Coldry and Ulysses A. Mejias. And they talk about data colonialism as a paradigm in which digitally we play out old colonial relations. So, we treat data as this cheap instance of nature that is just there for the taking, just like we've treated land resources in the past or people in the past. It's a resource that's just there for the taking. No permission asked, no consent required, just exploitative. And certainly generative AI, well, I'll point my finger here at OpenAI, who's built ChatGPT. Certainly OpenAI plays by these rules, or sort of abides by this framework. There's data that's just there for the taking. The whole internet for ChatGPT was just there for the taking. Mm-hmm. OpenAI didn't ask anybody's permission to pull, the New York Times articles, to pull Reddit threads, to pull Google searches. They didn't ask for anybody's permission to do that. They just did it. They just took it all. They took everything.
Right.
They took everything.
Yes.
And trained a product, and now they're selling it back to us.
Right.
So they take something that isn't theirs to take and then sell it back to us.
Wow.
And that is one example, I think, that Coldry and Mejias would say is data colonialism playing out.
Mm-hmm. And this counter discourse, I mean, this seems like getting to some of the things like what could we actually do about it? Some of the things that we're going to talk about at the end, we might be kind of on the tipping point of here. But I think framing the problem is part of it. Framing the kind of, you know, this is the situation that we're in. And that's a beautiful parallel, this kind of notion of there for the taking.
Well, I think one of the things that big tech did very early on with regard to writing was convince us that writing is a waste of time and words are cheap and useless.
Yeah.
This is something I wrote about and some of my earlier work that I really look forward to digging into in more detail. And it's this time it was Google. So Google was one of the first AI, generative AI players. And when they were developing their early AI, which is called Smart Compose, and you might be familiar with it if you're a Google user. It sort of predicts your next few words in Gmail or
Loathe it, but I do know it.
So when they were developing that and creating their campaign around it, they put out a ton of materials talking about the uselessness of writing and how repetitive it is, how time-consuming it is, how redundant it is, how painful it is. In order to get us as users, a term which we should also rebrand today, in order to get us to accept that it's a meaningless activity in our lives. And that set the groundwork for the sort of the next step in their playbook, which was to convince us that we could do better by giving writing over to an automated mechanical process, because we're all obsessed with self-optimization and efficiency and accelerating and doing more.
Faster, more, better. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they then, you know, created sort of brand new measures to show us how much more efficient we could be if we were using their product. So early on in the generative AI days, Google would talk about how many characters we were saving by using generative AI. And back in the day, in 2019, they were very proud to say that Smart Compose was saving users 2 billion characters a week, which was really nothing when you consider that Google had over a billion users. So we were all saving one character a week, which was like the letter N. Cool. But this is one way they set the groundwork for us to adopt and become more willing to accept generative AI. Convince us that an activity is useless.
Right.
Or a waste of our time. Play into our desires to be more efficient, to be more optimized, and then guide us into looking at new metrics that are frankly quite irrelevant,
right,
but give us a way to prove how much more efficient we are today.
Yeah.
And this was a really compelling case they made for seeding more ground to generative AI technologies, and mm-hmm. to give up more of our writing.
And they're also punching on that fear button too. Mm. The fear, like there's, you know, that fear of like, if you're not keeping up, if you're not using this text, then you're going to, these predictive texts, then you're going to be left behind in the, yeah. And it seems sometimes so odd to me that we have a slow food movement. We have macrobiotic movement. Like there's all these things in culture that are going, actually, maybe this is not so good for us. How come there is no corollary or equivalent there? Like people are not going, people want artisanal food. They want organic food. And they want slow food, you know, or all these things. They want to slow down and live at a human pace. But we don't see, but it sounds like your research is saying we do know that. We do know that we need human-paced communication.
I think we do know. I think the problem is that the people leading the campaign mm-hmm. right now for generative AI, it's industry, right, and it's they're profit-based organizations. And at the end of the day, that's why generative AI is so successful. It's because very enormous companies in Silicon Valley who have billions of dollars of skin in the game are the ones making sure it is successful.
Right, right. It's just the firepower of all that kind of blitzing the market, I guess.
Mm.
And yet there is the potential, I think, for even word sets like data colonialism, those small, when we click words together, those are the ways that I think in small ways we really can fight back. So let's move now onto how should AI be discussed right now? Your research states that discussions in the general public regarding AI are centered around the premise that AI is making us faster and more efficient. But that misses the point of what AI actually does. So how should we reframe this? Like, you've just done a great job, I think, sketching in how the AI is kind of centered this, how the marketing campaigns is like. Now, I guess we're getting to the part about how do we fight back? What can we do?
I think there's a lot of ways we can fight back, but the one I'll talk about right now is writing your question. So you asked, you know, what does AI do? What does AI actually do? And I think we need to think really carefully about the doing. What things do? We don't often think about technologies in that way. We think about technologies as these sort of the beautiful shiny objects they are before us. I'm pretending that I'm holding a smartphone in my hand, right? It's like this sleekly designed object, glass, 18,000 cameras, amazing colors. Like, that's how we think of tech. Mm-hmm. We don't often think of technologies as their implications or their consequences. And the theoretical concept that I remain obsessed with after a few years is called performative materiality. I'm using a phrase by...
I just dropped my pen. I got so excited. I'm taking notes for later. So tell us about that.
That's a phrase coined by Joanna Drucker back in 2013. And all it really means is that what something is has to be understood in terms of what it does. It makes me think of Forrest Gump, which took me, 25 years to understand. Sally Field saying what stupid is as stupid does. Mm-hmm. Same idea here. What things are is what they do. And it's funny because I think in life, we generally believe this. Like, if we think about how we value a partner, for example, like my partner to me is, of course, the person they are, but also the sum of actions, right? Like the acts of service, the interactions, the conversations.
Aww. Yeah.
We think of life this way. We think of our friends in this way, right? Mm. What they do.
They show up for you.
Exactly. Yeah. They're showing up.
Yeah.
Right? But somehow when it comes to technologies, we discard that, right? We don't think of them as their actions in the world. Or their consequences,
or
their
implications. Think of them as their potential or something.
That's completely divorced from the reality. Yeah.
Wow.
And so I think that one way we can start to fight back is to remember that technologies are events. And I'm leaning heavily here on Joanna Drucker. They're not isolated incidents. Well, speaking about isolated incidents, this reminds me of another professor, Canadian professor. His name is Ronald Deibert. He's at the University of Toronto, and he talks about technologies in this way. That's probably why I'm talking about them right now, in this way that different technologies used to be isolated incidents. For example, your TV was just your TV. Your phone was just your phone. Your software was just your software. But today he calls them an always-on connected mega machine.
That's a great phrase.
Totally. That's probably why I continue to quote him, because he comes up with so many amazing phrases. Another thing I aspire to be, a coiner of great phrases, an always on connected mega machine. And we need to remember that. We need to remember that technologies are events and implications. They are not just objects.
Now I'd like to shift into one of the things that's probably on a lot of our listeners' minds, which is the climate aspect of this. Now, many of us who are, even if we are well-informed, we might not exactly have a clear idea of how AI contributes to climate change. But take us through that. What are your problems with it in terms of how it contributes to climate change?
Here I will lean on a number of other scholars as well who have done just incredible work exposing the relationship between generative AI and climate. There's three ways really that AI contributes to climate change. And the first is training it. So training artificial intelligence takes a huge amount of electricity and water. So there's resources required just to train the thing. Then when we actually use the thing, there is more electricity and more water required. And using the thing, the technical term for that is inference. So in inference, there's more of a resource drain. Lastly, there are data centers that have to house all of the computer and cloud work that we do. Every time we are with AI, let's say generating a prompt, or we're inputting a prompt into ChatGPT, or saving something to the cloud that we've generated with artificial intelligence, data centers have to house all of the data that we generate every single day. Nothing exists in the cloud. Another amazing metaphor that big tech has deployed.
Yeah.
Nothing exists sort of like in the sky above
Magically.
Yeah. It doesn't. And the work of Mel Hogan, who is my PhD supervisor, really opened my eyes to the materiality of data centers. So that's one person I'm thinking of right now. There's been some wonderful work done really recently to try to give people a better concrete sense of the energy and water involved in producing or in training generative AI. One stat that's been quoted a lot is that every time right now you put a prompt into ChatGPT, actually it's like one to about 20 prompts, ChatGPT requires about a 500 ml bottle of water.
Wow.
So it's sort of glugging a bottle of water for, let's say, every couple dozen prompts that you're inputting into it. So multiply that by ChatGPT's millions of users, you know, every single day. And, you know, we could probably quickly arrive at an astronomical volume of water that's required just for ChatGPT. Going back, though, one previous step to training, which was the first thing I mentioned, water and AI have become inextricably linked. Meta is reported to have used 22 million liters of water to train their artificial intelligence called Llama 3. 22 million liters of water is an awful lot of water. And Google, for their data centers, they used over 21 billion liters of potable water in 2021. And it's only, sorry, that was 2022. 21 billion liters of water in 2022. And it's only going up. So I think we have a responsibility to think about the climate impacts of AI at this particular climate moment. The latest stats out of the United Nations are that 2 billion people live in water scarcity, right? And
yes.
So
yeah.
This is something I think about all the time, and we talk about in one of my courses all the time too, is if we're going to be deploying generative AI for what I like to call sort of like corporate white North American privileged uses, like making my life easier.
Right.
We also need to be thinking about those 2 billion folks living in water scarcity.
Right.
Right. Where do we want to divert one of the globe's most precious resources right now, when it literally is life and death? And I know some people think that's alarmist, and that being a skeptic with that type of alarm isn't so well received by a lot of folks. But I truly believe we have arrived at a climate moment where we need to make these choices.
Right. I don't know if it's alarmist to just ask altruism for whom. Right. If we're going to, you know, it's not always a one to one. Like, I like to try to pull things away from polarities whenever we can. And I feel like you've done that really well here in the conversation and really well in your own work by linking to this notion of altruism. We're sold something through its promise of altruism. But there is absolutely nothing wrong for noting that there is a lack of potable water in the global south, also in this country, for many communities, indigenous communities. Many communities still don't have that. And then to kind of picture this tech glugging water and kind of to, you know, when you said that, I just sort of pictured, I tried to hold in my mind how much potable water that is. There's no harm in just asking the question, altruism for whom? And the questions are sometimes the best ways to break up the polarity. So, I mean, maybe that is, and I'm kind of jumping ahead. We're jumping around a little bit here, but to this, how do we avoid moral panic or people disengaging? They're going like, I don't want to just be so freaked out or paralyzed or think that we're doomed. Like, how do we avoid moral panic or doom think or anything on this topic?
How do we avoid doom thinking, particularly around climate and AI?
Yeah. Yeah, or moral panic.
Yeah, moral panic. Let's deal with climate panic maybe first, and then talk about moral.
We're just rolling up our sleeves here.
Let's get into all the hardest topics as possible as we can. I think people start to feel panicked or boxed into a corner around AI when they really buy into big tech's branding there. Which, again, societally we've largely adopted. If you don't use it, you are going to be left behind. If you don't use it, you are doing your colleagues, your students, your whatever, a disservice. And I think if we can take one step back from that framing and see that it wasn't our framing to begin with, it came to us by way of a very deliberate campaign from very powerful companies who want to make billions of dollars, we can see that we have a bit of a different choice. Now, I know that's hard in practice when a lot of companies have jumped on board the AI train, even ours. Mount Royal University has, I would say, jumped on board the AI train.
It's tough to teach right now in the ways that we're, you know, that we're trying to. It's tough to exist in that environment without using any of the systems. It's just become, that's sort of seems to be the fait accompli of being a prof right now, even though lots of folks are finding ways around that and being creative about our engagement with it, for sure.
Totally. But I think that maybe rather than thinking about avoiding a panic, we have to think about embracing a set of ethics and values. What do we want to embody? What are our values? Do we want to be the kind of community that diverts water to writing essays faster, to writing communication plans faster, to producing an AI-generated video? Do we want that? Or do we want to be the type of community who is committed to getting Indigenous communities in Alberta better access to water, something they've been fighting for a really long time?
Right.
Who do we want to be?
Who do we want to be? And that ties to ethics, right? And it's not about morals. It's about ethics. Yeah.
And let's answer that question rather than letting big tech answer for us.
Mm.
We let them lead. Mm. And then we let them tell us that we're behind if we don't take their lead. And we let them tell us we're making the wrong choices. They don't operate ethically. No big tech company currently has in their set of ethical principles for AI any mention of climate or social justice, anything like that. In fact, Google just pared back its 7 principles of responsible AI development to 3, which still do not include anything related to climate, but not only that, now permit the development of AI for warfare.
Wow.
So they are not ethics first at all. Right. So what ethics do we want to embrace and who do we want to be?
It. And with that, I will say a huge thank you to our guest, a Mount Royal University professor and star researcher. Thank you so much for joining us here today. This has just been a mind-blowing conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are really lucky to have with us today in the studio Maren Walker, a 4th-year Mount Royal University information design student. And we're really lucky to have Maren come in and talk with us about the student perspective and her work in AI research. Just at the end, as I understand it, you're kind of a couple more weeks of school.
Yeah, wrapping up right now and kind of the sprint to the finish line currently. So
brilliant. Yeah. And so we're so happy that you could make time for us in this really busy time to come in and chat with us about your work. So if you could tell us first, Maren, how did you get involved in researching AI?
Yeah, so of course, like many other students here right now, I'd assume that ChatGPT came in like about halfway through my degree and is really cool, innovative. I could talk to it and it would, you know, have a conversation with me essentially. There's other AI tools like Midjourney that I could like generate an image from. And this is really interesting, especially as an information designer. I could use this as tools to kind of get past some creativity and brain blocks. But then after using this, kind of comes into, okay, so what's you know, how is this generated? How is this created? What's behind everything that I don't see as a consumer of AI? And so with this, I wanted to try and do a little bit more of a deep dive to understand what AI actually is. It's not, you know, Skynet or C-3PO from where we see in our like sci-fi movies, right? And so it's cool to kind of see this AI adoption so significantly, even in my lifetime, from when I was a little kid to now, it's transformed how we interact and communicate with each other in just this short amount of time. Oh, and wow. As a communication student, and I'm also just, I like technology in general, so seeing the shift is really cool, but I'm also trying to understand it more, not just from a consumer perspective, but what's behind there and see where my own perspectives are shaped by it.
I love that impulse to drill down. You know, of course, being an info design, you're going to want to get under the hood and try to figure out what makes this machine work, right? But that's also, I think, a really important impulse to just go, not just as a user, but where is it coming from? What is it doing? What's its impact? Was there a moment that kind of gave you pause, or you're kind of like, because the way that you talk about it is this friendly, it's like, yay, R2-D2, C-3PO, it's helping me, I can have a conversation, it's my friend. Could you put your finger on a moment when you started to think, is this friend 100%, you know, or like when did it shift? Or
I think for me, I started to realize I almost rely on AI too much when I encounter a problem. So if I don't know how to draft an email, it could be something simple as that. Or I'm like, oh, what do I type here? Then I go to ChatGPT and I'm like, okay, help me draft out an outline for what I can say. And I realized I feel like I'm losing some of my own problem-solving skills personally. And I became more cognizant of how I was using AI. Because before this, I wasn't as aware. And so kind of that like shift for me happened when I realized I'm defaulting to AI too much in my tool set, that I feel like I'm taking away some of my own skills that I could learn from the situation. And so part of this was, okay, I want to understand more behind it as a consumer.
That's a really neat kind of spark moment or a moment of realization. So then let's talk a little bit about your research. What has your research involved? Walk us through your process and your results.
Yeah, definitely. So a large part of this, with my data analytics minor, we, as like using data analytics, a lot of that has to do with some of the things that AI deals with, like machine learning, natural language processing. And we had a presentation and showcase that we put together. And so my personal interest is in AI and sustainability. So kind of at that intersection of those two domains. And it's really cool. So both part of this was to dive more into what AI actually is. And so kind of going to the point of, oh, it's artificial intelligence, but at the base of it is a set of algorithms that the computer can do to kind of replicate some of the human cognition tasks. And so, as you say, go to the conversation or some of those problem-solving skills. And so my research from this has been looking at some different articles and sources, so both academic and then also from the news, to try and see what's out there, what are some of the people who are much more experienced and knowledgeable than I am are saying, just to try and understand that own perspective. And with my emphasis on sustainability, I really wanted to dive into what's the environmental cost associated with this, and what's the sustainability of AI itself. I came across this really cool systems map, and I'm an information designer. And so it was called Anatomy of an AI System. And so it broke down the environmental considerations and the resource extraction that come with an Amazon Echo device.
Oh, neat. And that's just like your
Siri. So they're like your regular smart home little thing. I personally am a Google Home user.
Right.
I have it and throughout my house, and it's really cool. I love it. But then I saw this infographic. It's a huge systems map of this one little device that talks about the resource extraction. So like the geological materials that go into making this device. Then think of the supply chain to the like the water use, the mineral use, but then also the labor exploitation too, to get those materials to us. And then not to mention the actual training of the data sets for these AI that requires large computational costs.
Right.
And so when you think of just that one little Amazon Echo device and everything that goes into building it, it's quite an intensive, massive web.
Wow.
Was all interconnected. And so as an information designer, I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing, because exactly that is breaking it all down and making it visual.
So this connects with a lot of the things that we were talking about with Dr. Choksi. And this notion is that, we don't, in the moment that we're using it, we just need to ask ourselves, is it worth it? Because we were talking about how to avoid moral panic. It's like, on the one hand, we can't never use it. It's so embedded in there. There might be times where it really is helping humans. Like, there's healthcare and there's so how, but at least for the average person to know when they're using it, what the cost is, seems to be, you know, a way to be ethical and accountable and to know what we're consuming when we consume it.
To go along with that too, like something that I hadn't considered before was actual training of the AI data. So there's ethical implications on where that data is being sourced from. But then going into the computational cost, from one of my sources that I read, I believed it was around 300,000 tons of GHG emissions just for training one large language model, which is something like ChatGPT. So there's a huge emissions cost to that for how to... Yeah, like actually train these data sets.
And it's something we might want to think about because I know there's a lot of like what we would call frivolous use. Sometimes my students will talk about the ways that they use it and they'll say, they'll just ask it where they should go for dinner. Or, you know, it's like all these kind of tiny little decisions that we make every day. So there's kind of like the big choices and the little choices. The big ones being as huge as like military decisions that we're not sure we want to outsource. And then tiny little decisions in terms of like, you know, what kind of food do I want to eat tonight? It's like, should we abdicate all, you know, which decision should we ask for its help with or not? So I love that you kind of ask us to think about those implications and also mapping it out for us in that way. I'm really looking forward to looking at that infographic. I guess the last question that we have for you today is, how do we handle AI's advancements as individuals? And what strategies do you have or can we come up with together for grappling with its existence? You know, just the small questions
just small
here
little
today.
Question. This is increasingly interesting, especially as we go into this AI adoption stage where it's just so rapidly transforming our society. And this is pretty incredible. As myself, there's a lot of possibilities for adding in creativity and problem solving and enhancing our own influence and how we actually interact with AI. But then there is a lot of different, sometimes negative connotations or associations with that that we have to be careful about too. I was reading a Stanford paper from 2022, and a lot of what they were recommending is that right now we see AI as a lot of automation. So kind of taking the person away from doing some of these repetitive manual tasks. But there's also a lot of opportunity for augmentation. So still keeping the person at the center of this, but then augmenting some of the own skills and with our own developed skills of creativity, problem solving, to interpersonal skills. And so I think that's a huge pathway forward, is that adding in AI where we can to augment our own skills in the workplace and school, perhaps things like that, and use it as a tool, which is something that I truly believe in. I think it's really cool. As an information designer, there's so many times where I'm in a project, I'm like, I'm not sure what to do. And so I just try and send some ideas out there, and then it helps me, like, direct me into a certain project idea. I'm like, okay, that really resonates with me. But then it is interesting because I don't want to default to it for helping me write a professional email, which is something that I can do. I know I can do, but I just default to ChatGPT if I encounter a roadblock right away. And so as individuals, I think we really have to be conscientious of how we interact with it. So we can still problem solve. We can still do these cool things and still keep humans at the center of what we do. But then augmenting our processes to help us maybe reach greater heights or make that a little bit more efficient where possible, because AI isn't going anywhere anytime soon. But I think the way forward is just trying to be conscientious of it. And then also maybe, not defaulting to ask ChatGPT how to cook chicken for dinner or something like that. But being very cognizant of the inputs that we're putting into ChatGPT and that kind of effect.
I love that notion of augmentation. And you said augmentation rather than
automation.
Yeah. What a great distinction. I feel like that connects with a lot of the conversation we were having earlier about keeping the human at the center. Something that I tell my younger, I have two sons, and one thing that they just got phones They just turned 14 and mm-hmm. they weren't really very heavy phone users before. I use this example. You tell me what you think about it. I said, now, mm-hmm. You know, you like to use tools. They like to work with their hands. I'm like, if you think about it like a tool, mm-hmm. a hammer, a screwdriver, like you can get, you know, a fulcrum, for example. You think about, this is something that can help you do something. Mm-hmm. But if the screwdriver starts to boss you around, like, is that mm-hmm. the problem? You know, like, and so that to me, when you just said, if we think about it like human-centered and we think about it as augmentation versus automation, like anytime it starts to tell us what to do, mm-hmm. maybe we should have a little pushback. Is that fair? What do you think?
Definitely. That's something that I've held in my own belief since ChatGPT first came out, is that I never wanted to replace what I do in projects, but it helped me get past that kind of brain block sometimes of where do I go from here, or just sometimes encountering that. And so, yeah, exactly. Going back mm-hmm. to your point of using it as a tool and not allowing it to tell us what to do, right. but adding it into our process, just like anything else.
Mm-hmm. And keeping, back to your earlier point, mm-hmm. keeping in the picture what it costs.
Exactly.
The frivolous uses. Like, if we decide to use it, mm-hmm. then we should know what its costs are.
Exactly. And be educated consumers, because this mm-hmm. is only advancing more and more. And I can't even imagine what the next 5 years would be like. Never mm-hmm. mind in 20 years, what society will look like, what devices we're using at this time, because it's exponentially increasing right now.
Yes, this is a great point. One of my students this morning likened it to, she said, we are in, and she's also very, you know, engaged in this stuff. Mm-hmm. She said that we're right now in the dial-up stage. Like, if you imagine when the internet first came through and it's like, mm-hmm. and the dial-up modem, that's the stage that we're in right now with AI.
I would say that's fair. Yeah. I mean, AI has been here for a while. Mm-hmm. I remember my dad, he's a software engineer. He's talking about his initial perceptions of AI back in the 1990s. Like, that's cool, you know, nothing too crazy. But now it has fundamentally shifted to where it is today. And now he's like, whoa, this is so different than what I remember. And so and that adoption is only increasing. There's so many companies looking more into AI. And within the past 2 years of my degree, I've seen this crazy shift and development of ChatGPT and these different AI tool sets, I guess.
Thank you so much for being with us, Maren Walker. We wish you all the best with the end of semester. Mm-hmm. And hope you'll come back again and visit the show, you know, 5 or 10 years when you're out there killing it in the info design field.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me here today.
Thank you. That's it for this episode of Definitely Not the Ivory Tower. I hope your curiosity was piqued and that you're inspired to dig deeper into the reading and research we dipped our toes into today. I'm your host, Natalie Meisner, sending big thank yous to producer Ethan Ward and all the people who helped bring this episode together. Look out for our next episode by subscribing to Definitely Not the Ivory Tower on your podcast platform of choice. And be sure to tell your curious friends, family, and colleagues about us. We will catch you next time on Definitely Not the Ivory Tower. Definitely Not the Ivory Tower was produced on Treaty 7, the ancestral and unceded lands of the Niitsitapi Blackfoot, the Ahi Nakoda, the Tsuut'ina, and the Métis peoples. We recognize the historical and ongoing oppression that many Indigenous cultures and nations faced and still face within Canada. This podcast seeks to decolonize, to learn from the teachings of, and to work with Indigenous peoples across Turtle Island to spark change wherever possible.